I'd like to introduce to you Jim Hutt. Besides being a golf buddy, he's play golf every Saturday morning. Jim is his other job is a psychologist. You have your practice in is it Menlo Park or Palo Alto?
Menlo Park.
Menlo Park. And Jim specializes in relationships, correct me if I'm wrong, in how people relate to one another, how they talk to one another, and how they communicate. And I've asked him to come talk this Sunday and to speak on those topics. So, Jim, thank you for coming and welcome to Chikoji.
I appreciate being here. Thank you very much. What I'd like to do is have all of you who want to ask a question at any time, make a comment at any time, participate with me. Let's make this something we do together rather than me talking to you or at you. I'd really like to just share some ideas with you I have about my experiences of being with couples in relationship, significant relationships, whether it's been with parents to children, siblings with one another, lovers. I've had, since 1979, I've been sitting with couples and listening to their stories. And I've learned a lot from them. And so I wanted to share some of what I've learned in the little bit of time we have today with you all, but also hear from you, any of your thoughts or questions that you might have that I could speak to. And when I was thinking about this talk, I was going back over my mind about how to actually present what it is I'm actually faced with when a couple comes into my office and wants to talk about their relationship. And what I realized is that what they say is one thing, but what they're really asking for and what they're really experiencing is another thing. And they're in touch with what they say. For example, the most common things I hear are, we don't communicate. We need communication skills. And the closer, you know, that's a very general way of saying things. But one of the things that they often say is at the end of a difficult interaction, a fight, basically, is they don't feel heard and they don't feel understood. And what I realized in thinking back over all the years is that what people, couples more often present than not to me is a sense of helplessness. And so what I really am in doing when I'm sitting with somebody is getting in touch with what it is that they're experiencing in their helplessness. What are they helpless about? Do they even know they're helpless? And a lot of couples don't. Much of their life seems like it's very much in order. But when they interact with each other, they repeat the same patterns over and over again. I'm sure that my wife, Joyce, and I do the same thing. Joyce is my wife, by the way. And breaking out of a pattern is a very difficult thing to do, and it's difficult for a number of reasons. And so I'll talk a little bit about what some of those reasons are. I think also one of the things that's part of the helplessness that I hear people expressing to me is they don't know, they actually can't talk about experience. They can tell me that they were angry, they can tell me they were hurt, or they can say they're frustrated, or that they don't feel loved, but they don't seem to have a way to sort of think about what experience is. And what I've noticed is that there seems to be three realms of data that make up experience for couples. And one is the cognitive or the intellectual. Another one is the emotional or the feeling state. And the third one is the behavioral state. So it's thinking, feeling, and doing. And a lot of times when couples come in and describe to me what's happening, they're talking about usually one of those three more than the other, maybe two, but seldom all three. So one of the things that I help people with or try to sit with people to get them to begin to think about is, well, what are they doing on all three levels, on the thinking level, the feeling level, and the behavioral level. But the other difficulty, I think, is if you're not in touch with those, number one, a creeping sense of helplessness starts to get into your life. But the other thing that I think leads to the helplessness is when I watch couples talk to one another, they seem to talk more about the other one than about themselves. It's sort of like if you go to the physician to talk about what's ailing you, you wouldn't talk about the physician, you'd talk about yourself. And if you talk about yourself, you'll be understood, hopefully. The healer or the physician will ask you questions, will probe, will be very curious about what you're experiencing, and will eventually get to a place where there's some understanding of what's wrong, and will give you what you need to help you feel better. But we don't seem to do that in relationship with one another. We tend to speak more about the other. When you do X, I don't like it, so you stop doing X and I'll be happy. And we hear this and immediately, you know, feel defensive or have some kind of explanation or something that says, I don't want to be too much a part of what's going on here because apparently I'm in charge of your happiness, but it's very hard for us to make somebody else happy. So part of the helplessness I think that people experience when I see them relates to that. So one of the things that I want to impart to people is how to get back on their own side of the street, take responsibility for what actually happens for them, and talk about that. So if I tell you, instead of saying, you do X, please stop X, or you better stop X or else, and getting you to comply, if I draw back and say, you know, when you did X and situation Y, let me tell you what my Z is, and then I go into my Z, which is what I think, what I feel, and what I do. For example, almost every week I have somebody who comes in and says to their partner, there isn't anything about the way that you talked with me that makes me think you have any desire to understand anything I have to say whatsoever. You never listen, you always yell, and you just don't seem to care at all about me. And it's probably not an uncommon thing for most of us to have said to somebody we care about at some point in some way along the way. As opposed to saying, when we talk and I'm interrupted and I can't get my thoughts out, I feel very frustrated. And when I get frustrated at trying again to say something and I can't say it, then I start to feel scared. And when I get scared, I back away. And when I back away, I feel distant from you. And when I get distant, I feel scared. And when I think about that, to me, it seems like we're two ships in the night. And two ships in the night is a very scary thing because I eventually think one of us will sail away in the night and never come back. That's a very different expression of experience rather than saying, shut up and listen to me, I got lots to say. And that tends to be what we do. So part of what I work with people on is how to think about talking and how to think about listening. This culture of ours, in my opinion, teaches us to talk and to listen with the idea of with a competitive position. We fight to win. And we think we don't separate conflict from fighting. A conflict is a difference. Male, female is a difference. You and me is a difference. I'm not you, you're not me. That's difference. You, because of who you are, you think about things different than the way I do. If we fight about what each other thinks, we're mismanaging the difference between how we think. Okay? So it's really important when I find people who say to me, oh, I'm so afraid of conflict. Well, they're actually, when we get down to it, they're less afraid of conflict than they are afraid of fighting. They're afraid that somebody's going to say something that'll hurt their feelings, do something that'll hurt them physically. Their voices will be raised. They will tap into old familial stuff they were raised with, perhaps with fighting parents or with silent parents, parents who provided the silent treatment to children who were naughty, instead of connecting with their kids about what they did and have some other way of interacting around it. So couples get very, very frightened about conflict many times, and they say, I'm afraid of conflict. So one of the things I try to impart to people is to separate out conflict as a difference and fighting is a mismanagement of the difference. Let's talk about how to manage the conflict in a way that's effective. So what does that mean? To me, what that means is being able to listen to the speaker, to the one who's got the issue, talk about what it is that he or she's experiencing. and it's listening purely for the purposes of understanding their experience, not trying to fix it, not trying to bring any kind of consolation necessarily, but listening, just listen. I can't remember who it was that told me in my office one day, why do you think we have two ears and one mouth? That's the ratio of listening to talking. And I thought, wow. There was some adolescent who told me that. I was an adolescent female. I'll never forget it. And I thought it was absolutely brilliant. I said, she goes, hello, you know, two ears, one mouth, you know. It's like, so I thought, well, it's really amazing. So what does it mean to talk? Well, it means to talk about oneself versus the other. And what does it mean to listen? It means to be curious about the other's experience. What is experience? It's what I think, what I feel, and what I do, regardless of how rational it may be by anybody's standards, let alone your own, how logical it may be. It is. It is what it is. And what I find with couples is that as they actually let go of whether or not what they're hearing makes any sense to the listener, it certainly makes sense to the speaker, figure out how. That's what's really important. It's one of the biggest challenges I know that I have, is being able to listen to Joyce or one of the kids and not think, okay, what can I do about this? What's wrong with what I'm thinking or with what they're thinking? Oh, that's not right. Let me set the record straight. None of which keeps the connection together. And I think, you know, one of the things we start to feel helpless about are those subtle things, unconscious things that break our connection, and there's a fear that we won't get it back. Now, the problem is, culturally, every institution that we come in contact with, including the family, our schools, our churches, etc., for the most part, reinforces competitive communication, not cooperative communication. Competitive communication is about winning and being right. It's about providing solutions. It's about what's wrong with the way you think. And yet we're told to be cooperative. So we have this weird thing going on simultaneously. Be cooperative, but be competitive. If you want to win, this is how you win. This is how you argue. You go back and you tell that friend of yours, dot, dot, dot. Or you go back into that institution and you do, dot, dot, dot. We tend to be solution providers without really first hearing what is the real experience going on here. I can't tell you how many times, and I got to tease my kids about this a lot in high school. They'd come home, we'd sit at the dinner table, and they'd complain about teacher. And I learned long before that to just shut up and listen. But if I wanted to have fun with them, my daughter in particular, I'd say, you know what, I'm going to give that teacher a call. No, Dad, don't do that. Don't do that. I'd say, what? You know, I did it for fun, but it would always reinforce in me the idea that we need to listen more. But we aren't listened to very much culturally. Institutions that we go to don't listen to our experience because there's too much to get done, apparently. There's too many things to learn, too many things to do, so we can't really deal with experience. And that begins at home.
Do you get a sense that some people just want to be heard? They don't actually want a solution or a feedback, but they just want to be heard?
Absolutely. It's funny you mention it. Rand Corporation did a study and found, did two really seminal studies. One showed that 8 to 9 times out of 10 in any venue, this is interesting, any venue, that means in businesses, at home, with marriage, anywhere, 8 to 9 times out of 10, conflict is resolved without solution.
Hmm. Conflict is resolved without
solution. 8 to 9 times out of 10, that's 80 to 90%. What does that mean? That means it must be the process is flawed. The process of listening and talking must be somehow flawed. So that, remember, well, some of you would remember looking at your ages here, Saturday Night Live, when Rosanna Dana would talk, and she would go on and on and on, and then she would say, never mind. And that's what actually happens a lot. When we listen to somebody, it's like, oh, wait a minute. Actually, the conflict here is not about who's right or wrong. It's about not understanding what was actually happening. Now that I've heard you, I get it. I understand. And there's another study that they did that showed that only 8% of the messages that we give each other come across in the words. It's the other 92% comes across in body language and tone of voice. So we communicate a lot. I hear people tell me every day, we don't communicate. Oh, yes, you do. We tend to communicate a lot, and we tend to communicate the wrong stuff. We tend to communicate accusation, blame, name-calling, anything about judging the other. We spend more time communicating than about expressing ourselves and what we think, what we feel, and what we do. And that's what I think the remedy to the helplessness is getting people on the same page around the ability to listen to what somebody thinks and somebody feels and how they respond. Because if it's true, if Aaron Beck and Albert Ellis and all the cognitive people, even Epictetus was the ancient philosopher who said it's not events that hurt us, but what we make of them. And if you fast forward to current times, it's not what they say, you say, it's what I hear. If you tell me, you know, Hud, I think you're a jerk, I can hear that one of two ways. I can think, oh my gosh, you know, I grew up with parents who didn't like me and that they just confirmed I'm a jerk. Or I can think, wow, if I'm being called the name, something powerful is going on over there, I wonder what it is. And so I can ask something really powerful like, what do you mean? If you're calling me a name, you must be thinking or feeling something. Would you be willing to tell me that? If we would do that with one another, we would experience far less helplessness. On the other hand, if I blame you for my experience and tell you that you've got to change to make me happy, now I'm basically injecting helplessness into myself. And so I see the interactions with people who desperately want to be heard. If they could simply be trusted to be heard, and you're right, if they are heard, they tend to feel much better. Even if they're heard with no solution given, with no advice given, they're just heard. Somebody goes, wow. Wow. Yeah.
Well, I love this topic, the listening topic, because when I first started practicing Buddhism, one of the emphasis on Buddhist practice is compassion. And I had such a hard time with compassion. Like, I didn't feel like I had any capability to be compassionate or even to develop some kind of practice that would cultivate compassion. And then I heard this story, and I tell a story all the time because somehow it fits into every topic that we talk about in the circle. This Zen master was asked by some foreigner that came to Japan to listen to him talk and said, what's the core of all your teachings? And he said, an appropriate response. And the guy said, well, first of all, how do you know it's an appropriate response? And second of all, how do you get there? And the master said, by getting close and doing nothing, or by being close and doing nothing. And to me, it kind of, what he was saying was kind of being really close and intimate with a person or a circumstance or situation and not really doing anything, like not giving a solution or not trying to avoid it or fix it, but just listening, like a deep listening. And then, you know, once I started to let that teaching or that story kind of flower in my life, I started to realize that, wow, I'm acting compassionately, or I'm being compassionate in this situation or towards this person. And really what I was doing was just listening, you know, like you were talking about, listening without an agenda, like not to try to hear what they're saying so I could come back with my own point of view, or, well, they're wrong and I'm gonna listen to what they say just so I can, you know, find a way to tweak it to get them to come to understand what I have to say about the situation. So.
Yeah, thank you for that. That's very interesting, and it's so true, I think, because it gets to a point where you know, if you think about thinking, feeling, and doing at some point becomes being. When you're really being who you are and you're truly being authentic with whomever it is your intimate partner is with you at that moment and you're in conflict, simply the behavior is the being present. It's the listening and not making any kind of judgment. That's why one of the things, in a very practical way, when you're hearing your partner talk to you, or whomever it is that you're talking to that you might be in conflict with, to recap what you heard. Now, recap is a pretty tricky thing, but it's a very important thing. And I say it's tricky because it's not the transcriptionist version of what you heard. It's your interpretation.
Do you actually say it back to the person?
Yes, and you say it back. You say back what you heard, what your interpretation is, and you ask if it's accurate and complete. If it's not accurate and complete, then the speaker says, no, see, you don't listen just like I always thought. Way to go. No, that's not true. Then you say, let me say it again a different way. If you're speaking English to somebody who only speaks French, it doesn't help to get louder and say it again in English. But this is what we do with each other. We say the same thing over again and go, what's wrong with you that you don't get it? We don't consider, well, maybe I didn't put it across. I've certainly been responsible for saying things to Joyce in a way that she did not understand, and it was not because she couldn't hear it. It was because I wasn't saying it in a way that it could be reasonably understood the way I wanted it to be heard. So we have a role to play in what we say, but we also have a role to play in what we hear. On a really pragmatic level, the more frequently we can tell somebody who's talking to us what we heard, the more likely they're going to feel understood and the more likely we are to get the message that was sent. But we don't tend to do that. We think listening means being quiet and not being active. But there's two levels of being active when we're listening. And one is, you know, what am I feeling and how can I keep my own reactivity under control so it doesn't jump in the way? And the other way is, how do I let this person know frequently what they're telling me? And that's a real art that takes a lot of practice. It takes lots of conflict. And if you can understand that all conflict is a difference and see conflict as something neutral, then it's all about the process you employ. And you're always in charge of your own side of the street. So if things are going poorly and each person draws back and looks at themselves instead of pointing a finger at the other. I had a couple the other day and seen them for the first time, and we were talking, and I said, so what would you say the problem is? And she said, he is. It's like, well, okay. So I look at him. Yes.
I thought I'd just bring this up just because how well it seems to work. That book, Men from Mars, Women from Venus.
John Gray.
I had at one time I had a girlfriend who asked, here, you know, take a look at this book. And we actually knew we had met the author. We happened to know the guy. And I'd read parts of it, and it goes on. It's very thorough, so I can't keep reading it. But skipping around was much more entertaining.
Yeah.
And she came back to me and said, if I'd read this book, 80% of all the crap between us would not have happened. It's just that men and women are built differently, think differently, different orientation. Of course they're going to, and that was 80% of the cause of the problems.
Yeah, thank you for that. That's so true. What we don't realize, our culturally what we think is that conflict is always synonymous with war and fighting. But in terms of relationship stuff, I don't believe that. I think that conflict is actually the royal road to intimacy. If the unconscious is the royal road to, or if dreams are the royal road to the unconscious, well, I think that intimacy, if you want to get there, the royal road to that is conflict. Conflict is what brought us together in the first place. One looked at the other and said, ooh, now I could be with that one. That's nice. Because of the difference. Right? So if we think about conflict as difference, and it's a good thing, the only thing that's going to keep us separate when there's conflict is a bad process, not the conflict itself. So it's really, it's very interesting to try to think about, you know, people say, well, some things are harder to talk about than others. Well, yes and no. One of the reasons things are harder to talk about than others is that they trigger in us powerful stuff. And that's where the difficulty is. It's not really with the content itself. Content is something that triggers. One person might find dealing with a particular issue not that difficult, and another person might find it the most painful, powerful thing in the world. Which tells me that it's really not about the content. It's about how each individual experiences whatever that content triggers in them. And we're all going to be triggered based on our history. Now, let me talk a little bit about history very quickly from two points of view. There's the Freudian point of view, the unconscious, which I think is very, very real and can be very helpful. But there's another, and that's all I'm going to say about that right now. But then there's another point of view, the neurological point of view, that in the last 5 years or so, psychology has become very interested in, and I think has done some really interesting things to help. We used to say, if you want to have a better relationship, become a better person. How do you become a better person? Well, by getting into counseling, by reading books, by focusing on what's wrong with you. Very pathology-oriented, if you will. But now, with the research that's been done with the neurological side of things with the brain, my friend Pete Pearson from the Couples Institute, he and I both have adopted the notion that if you want to have a better relationship, deal with your brain differently. And here's what I mean. We have three brains, basically. We have the reptilian brain, the old brain. The brain is the very back of the head, goes down the spinal cord. It's the part of the brain that keeps us alive without having to think. Blood pressure, body temperature, heart rate, all the autonomic nervous systems. The brain that we're glad Congress has, so that they can stay alive without having to think. And we have the mammalian brain, or the limbic brain. And the limbic brain is the brain that we used to mostly be. We're reptilian and limbic, or limbic is also known as mammalian. It's the brain, it's the fight-or-flight brain, it's the survival brain, it's the center of the brain where all the pain centers are located, all of the pleasure centers, it's the center of all the emotions. And it basically acts kind of like a radar dish scanning the horizon for danger. That's what its major function is. And when it notices something, it keys in on it, and it records it and stores it. Everything we've ever experienced is actually recorded and stored in our limbic brain. Now, most of the things we experience in our daily lives are not powerful enough to be recalled. You get up, you move to the other side of the room, you sit down and pick up a book, will be recorded, but you're not going to think much about it because nothing bad happened. The bad stuff is what really gets remembered. Some of those, and it gets remembered in quotes. We don't always have a conscious memory of it because some of the things that happened to us that were, quote, bad, meaning negative or powerfully negative, happened before we had language. What do we do with those? We don't have language, we can't codify, and if we can't codify, we can't express. So, what happens? The body remembers it. It gets dished out. If you were beaten as a six-month-old, you're not going to remember that with language, but you will remember it one way or another. It will happen. Then we've got, and I'll come back to that, then we have the cortex, the bigger part of the brain, which evolved out of the limbic brain. There was a point when we were mostly limbic, when there were lots more physical dangers around us, and we needed much more limbic activity. So now, what happens, let's say, for example, you had a parent who, every time you made a mistake, got a snarly face and yelled at you. Fast forward to adult life, and you have a partner in your life who gets mad at you, snarls their face, and yells. What's it going to do? It's going to remind you. The limbic brain will know, I know what to do with this. Shut up, don't say a word, and everything will be fine. And so that's what you do. Problem is, the way it works
That's flight, right?
Pardon me?
That's a kind of flight.
That's a kind of flight.
Yeah.
There's two ways we tend to deal with very difficult situations. We either get big, or we get small. Getting small means we might run, get quiet, give the silent treatment, skulk around. Get big means we'll yell, we'll fight back, we'll push, we'll hit, and so forth. So running is a way to get small. Staying there and fighting it out is a way to get big. But the way these brains work is what's important, and particularly between the limbic brain and the prefrontal cortex, which is right behind the forehead. That's the CEO of the brain. That's the part of the brain that we think with, do analysis with, make inductions, reductions, decisions. It's a very, very powerful part of the brain. Now, what happens is the limbic brain is built to be at odds with the prefrontal cortex. So that way, when you're standing in front of a bus coming at you, you don't think, wow, what a brilliant color of yellow. You just get out of the way. Or pulling the finger off the burner. You don't think, you just get out of the way. The way it works is really simple. The limbic brain sends a signal to the adrenal glands, right above the kidneys, and says, send a little bit of adrenaline up to the prefrontal cortex and shut that baby down a bit. We got a little danger here. Aye, aye. It happens, and the prefrontal will stop working enough to get you through the moment. Now, if you're having a knockdown dragout with your partner, guess what? You're going to be highly limbic and very low prefrontal. And what do you think, when do you think we say things we wish we hadn't said? When we're really limbic, highly prefrontal. And then after it settles down, we have all the apologies to make, which, by the way, doesn't happen very much in our culture. I hear that a lot, almost every day in the office. And one of the reasons we don't have a lot of apologies in our culture, I believe, is because nobody handed them out when we were younger. They really weren't very plentiful. The institutions don't do that. They give what we call the double-handed apology. Well, you wouldn't be, I'm really sorry that this hurts, but the but is, takes the apology away. Anyway, that's another story for another day. So with our brains being built to be at odds with one another, and with us being told to be competitive, in other words, we're reinforcing limbic activity over prefrontal activity, and we're not told or taught how to manage strong emotion, by the time we fast forward to adulthood and get involved in an intimate relationship, we're really heavily mired in very powerful patterns that we developed as children and get reinforced in our relationships later on in life. We don't develop too many patterns once we get involved in our marriages or significant others or partnerships. We carry those into those relationships, and those relationships later reinforce those patterns, whatever the pattern may be. We all have them, patterns of interacting. When we're in conflict, we do whatever we do, and it works to the extent it works, and we rinse, wash, and repeat frequently, trying to break out of them, but it's very hard to break out of patterns that are neurologically, neuronally set. That we now know in the research that neuronal patterns run deep and they run powerfully and they're very hard to break. So really, when you think about wanting to change the way you might interact with people in general or with intimate people in particular, think about breaking a pattern. Identify the pattern. What do I do when I interact with this person that's difficult for me, and how would I change that if I could? There's a much better question to ask than, boy, I sure wish he or she would stop whatever the heck they're doing because I can't tolerate it. It'd be better off telling the other person, when you do X in situation Y, here's my Z. It's really painful for me. And that's really, I think, one of the keys to the helplessness that I experience people coming in with, is not understanding we have much more control over changing those neurological or neuronal patterns. We have much more control over changing and keeping track of our side of the street than the other. And that's really very hopeful. That starts to bring some hope into what oftentimes feels very helpless for people. And couples in particular, I find, participate in what I call relief divorce. A relief divorce is a divorce that happens because there's so much pain. And the limbic brain will do anything to reduce pain, anything. It's meant to provide relief. We just want relief. And if we can get relief, we'll feel better. I've had couples now, because I've been in practice for more than 30 years, who have cycled back and said, you know, the divorce I got 17 years ago, didn't even get it. I'm okay. I actually have another marriage and whatnot, but now that I look back, I just wanted the pain to go away. Didn't need to do it. They're actually a pretty nice person. And that's not true for everybody, but for some it is. Yeah.
Eric, negative thinking is linked to survival.
Yes, it is.
And so the positive actually is being mined is plastic. This is where the practice and the discipline of inducing this negative thinking to change it into something positive. To exchange it, I guess.
Well, the negative thinking, one way to think about negative and positive thinking is that, first of all, we now know that the brain can only respond to a positive command. In other words, if I say to you, don't think of an elephant, you're likely to think of an elephant. If I say to you, stop yelling, or don't be anxious, you're liable to be anxious, and you may be insulted that I told you what to do and say, don't tell me to stop yelling. If I want to yell, I'm going to yell. But if I say, when you yell, I get very scared, could you bring it down a notch? I understand you're angry. But if you brought it down a notch, I'd be more likely to hear you. You might be more receptive. And I've also given your brain the chance to actually give itself a positive command. That's why it's very helpful to say to yourself, if you're going into an anxiety-provoking situation, rather than, God, I hope I don't blow it. So you know what? Instead of blowing it, I'm going to think about what my task is. I'm going to do my task the way I planned it, which is dot, dot, dot. And you predict the outcome. Somebody once said to me, if you want to predict the future, create it. Okay. One of the ways to create it is by giving your brain positive commands to respond to. And that way you can convert a negative thought. It's negative to think, oh my gosh, I'm about to be killed. But it will lead to your survival if you get out of the way of that bus, for sure. But when it comes to interacting with each other, if I'm thinking negatively about you, I'm now not thinking about me in a way that I can actually be productive in conveying to you what's going on with me. So that, it's a very different way to think about interacting with each other.
Not easy.
Any other comments, questions, stories?
As a comment, I come back to what Abhijah said. This, a lot of our training and a lot of the Zen practice is for non-doing, for not, you know, where you sit in this posture, so we're pretty rigorous, and non-thinking is part of Zen, and while we're sitting, and then feeling is tied with thinking, so the non-thinking also somewhat, you let the feelings just go, you don't dive much into them. So you come down to being, and that is a way of sort of being with yourself, being, you feel the compassion for yourself and others, and that sort of is a natural therapeutic thing. And also it develops sort of a relation to the subconscious, because the phrase that when it becomes purified, that is when the subconscious becomes conscious, it gets naturally purified through the factors that you're talking about. So I'm wondering if whether there is some interaction between our training and the sort of the active that could be further. I know a lot of people in Zen, including myself, were badly affected by a lot of neurotic factors, and yet I see a lot of therapeutic things coming out of Zen as well.
The short answer to that is I don't know. The slightly longer answer is I think part of what you're talking about is, you know, what do you do when you're moving from a really difficult place around some of the wounds we carry, and how those get manifested in our relationship. And, you know, how do you get beyond some of that? I mean, you can only get beyond it with risk. Risk builds trust. And trust is never built without risk, if you think about it. You meet somebody, you don't know them, and you decide, okay, we'll go to the movie. That's a risk. See how it goes. Or we'll meet for coffee in a public place and see how it goes. It's a risk. And it goes well, you've got a little bit of trust built. And if you've had some wounds from the past that are ever present, the limbic brain is not letting you forget those, so to speak. And you're going to honor those and keep a distance of a particular sort. The only way that you can experience more of the intimacy that would be commensurate with the degree of being that you want or have would be to take more risk, I would think. But I don't know enough about your training to be able to speak about that intelligently.
Maybe you and Mike can work it out.
But I think what I hear you saying is something about that the practice of sitting and being with just being is in itself a practice in reducing that reactivity that you were addressing, that, you know, how we get so charged, that just being is in itself practicing not being reactive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess the challenge... Yeah, thank you. I think that the challenge would be then how to use that in an interaction without being seen as becoming passive and non-participative. Mm-hmm. So that's probably what you meant when you're asking a question. I didn't understand that.
Well, one thing that seems really interesting is about the breath, which to me might be linked to some of these more ancient parts of the mind mean, obviously it is, and it sustains our life, right, our breath. But for me, that's one of the essence of the practice, is the breath, and taking 10 deep breaths before I encounter an anxiety situation is extremely helpful.
Oh, yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. You know, one of the, if you notice yourself in any situation, notice people around you in any anxiety-provoking situations, they start to breathe. You can notice they're breathing. Kids do it before they take tests. You do it before you do maybe an event of some kind. You take these deep breaths.
Deep breath, yeah.
And
different than shallow.
Well, one of the things that all of the breathing does is it actually, the whatever amount of oxygen it puts back into the body reduces the flow of adrenaline. Mm-hmm. And that's a relatively new finding in the last 20 or 30 years or so, medically. So when I have people come in and ask me sometimes, should I breathe? Well, yeah. That would be okay. Please, don't stop in here.
I was, I remember when I first started practicing, this is my mom here sitting in the chair, and I remember when I first started practicing Buddhism, and I started trying to relate to her, or trying to explain to her my experience in practice, and she found it all very dispassionate, like you said. She would be like, well, why do you want to be so disconnected from people and so detached? You know, you're not going to really be with people, and what kind of way is that to live? And so then there's, and also I hear what you're saying as far as there's being present and being doing nothing with that, but then also how you turn that space into a positive engagement interaction with another person or situation. And I found that, you know, through my practice of being close to doing nothing, like what Cliff was saying, is getting down to that just core of just being in the moment, there's some kind of spontaneous ability to respond, like the master was saying, responding appropriately. So I found, like I was trying to explain to my mom at one point, was actually by kind of like taking myself, resting in the observer place of the observer, where I'm being close and doing nothing, I actually was becoming a lot more intimate with not just the person or situation, but myself and the experience of it. So then I think that it kind of relates to what you're talking about, is it's like, you know, when you have that space of just being or being present, being close and doing nothing, that intimacy that I've found that I've had by doing that makes me more intimate with myself as well. So then I'm able to not only listen to the other person, but share my experience with them without being so attached to what I'm feeling, what I'm thinking, you know, and holding on to it so tightly that I have to, you know, fight for it, you know.
Yeah, I really appreciate you saying that. It's because what I hear you describing is the difference between what might look passive to the other person, but which truly is very active. It's very, very open, very receptive, and very present. Reminds me of a guy I saw years ago from the Midwest, who grew up on a farm with a huge family, and they never spoke at the dinner table. Never. And I said, wow, what was that like? And he said, well, it's kind of like we're all present and unaccounted for. And what you're talking about is exactly the opposite. It's really being quiet, but in a way that's so obviously receptive. And if two people are on the same page about that, I could see where that would be a magnificent thing, regardless of whether or not there's conflict.
One of the powerful things of sitting here in the Zendo is, in fact, because it's wordless, I feel a connection to people in ways that words can't touch. It's behind the words, the experience. So sitting in a table, eating with other people in silence is incredibly powerful and very beautiful and interconnected to the world that's around you and to people that you're sharing that with, without saying a word.
It could be in our meditation situation. Is that what you're saying? Yeah.
Your talk reminds me of a Japanese scholar who is influenced by the philosopher Nishida Kitaro. Nishida Kitaro is a good friend of D.T. Suzuki. While Suzuki is a monk, but Nishida is a philosopher, tried to explain the Zen idea by using Western terminology. The scholar of psychoanalysis, he once said the expression like self as a relationship. That explains, you know, if self is like you and me, and you are you and me and me, it's like self as a relationship is like like you said, conflict. Conflict is within our within the field of the self. So I think so to see the difference, to see the conflict, that's not others, but it's in the field of the self, self as relationship.
Interesting. Very interesting.
From the idea of Zento, that's really interesting.
Yeah, thank you.
Comparison.
Very interesting. Thank you for that.
You're a visiting scholar at Stanford
Yes.
from Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And is it, what is your field? What do you teach?
Eco-criticism and environmental thought.
Eco-criticism.
Dealing with environmental issues.
Uh-huh.
And environmental thought at the same
time. Yeah, it's interesting. Just a word about criticism. I think that, you know, we're very sensitive to being criticized, all of us. And that has early roots in it too, because when we're young and we're toddlers and infants, we're learning everything could be critiqued, and it often is. But some couples have learned one really interesting way about dealing with criticism that I really like, that I've learned from the couples I've seen, which is criticism is about the other, but a complaint is about me. And if I'm going to complain about something, I will say, this room's too cold for me. A criticism would be, you never turn the heat up high enough. Maybe it's a small thing, all right, but it's still in the other direction. And so what I learned from that is, all right, well, let's see if you can talk about yourself and complain. Complaining becomes good all of a sudden, and criticism becomes unnecessary. Now, I understand people can ask for feedback, which we could call criticism, that's fine. But in terms of how you manage conflict in a way where you keep it safe, but you still don't have to sell yourself out, because let's face it, if you have to sell yourself out, it's not safe. And if you're running roughshod on somebody, that's not safe. So sometimes managing criticism, looking at something as critical versus complaining, can be very helpful in terms of how we interact with one another. But it's very different. It's a very different way to look at it. Well, that's all I have for today. If anybody has anything else, I'd be glad to hear it, talk about it.
Any more questions?